Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 24th of September. The MOD is sending hundreds of British troops to Cyprus in preparation for a possible evacuation of UK citizens from Lebanon. It comes as tens of thousands of people are pouring out of southern Lebanon, areas under Israeli bombardment. We'll hear from a man who is hosting multiple families in his house near Beirut, and assess how much damage Israel is doing to the Iranian-backed militia. Also, Keir Starmer has spoken about a light at the end of a tunnel in his conference speech. We'll discuss what he had to say with the Environment Secretary. What might be in President Zelensky's new plan for victory he's presenting to President Biden? We'll ask a former Ukrainian defence minister. And we hear about the impact of NHS cuts in Northern Ireland on families who have children with special needs. You're listening to The World Tonight with James Kamarasamy. The sound of an exodus from southern Lebanon today. Traffic heading into the city of Sidon as families escaped from intense Israeli bombardment, which has killed more than 500 people over the past 48 hours. The Israeli airstrikes and the casualties were much fewer in number today, but Israel said it had killed a Hezbollah commander in Beirut and signalled that it would press on with its campaign against the Iranian-backed militia, whose rockets have been flying into northern Israel for the past 11 months in support of Hamas.
We're striving for the operation to be as short as possible. That's why we're striking with huge power. But we have to be prepared for it to take time. Our mission in the end is to achieve the war goal and bring the residents of the north back to their homes. And we have to stand by our mission.
Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari of the Israeli Defence Forces there. Well, it's clear this evening that the British government is stepping up plans for a possible emergency evacuation of UK citizens from Lebanon. The MOD is sending extra military personnel to the region. First, let's hear now of the tens of thousands of people who are fleeing from the south. Some of them are being housed in temporary displacement centres. Others are relying on the kindness of friends, relatives and strangers. Among those offering to help is Fadi. He lives in a town called Hamana. It's about 20 miles east of Beirut. And he told me how many people had arrived there over the past couple of days.
In our area, it's completely like around 3,000-4,000.
How many people do you have living with you at the moment?
In this moment, I have 28 persons. 16 adults with my kids, all in total 28.
And how big a space are they living in?
We have 3 bedrooms and another flat. It's also 3 bedrooms. We are living in 2 flats. Before 15 minutes, I see people in the road. My concierge, he find for them house. They are like around 17 persons. There is a second building, you know, the block A, block B. And the block B, they live in 1 flat, 17. Now they accept them.
So this is just before you spoke to us, you found a place for 17 other people.
Before 15 minutes, 17 other people in the other building, in the block B, they speak with the owner. She accepts them to come with no money, just to help them.
And where are they coming from?
Direct in the border. But before they come, our neighbor, you know, someone in the Lebanese army, she take his ID and she check with the Lebanese army if they have anyone fighting with Hezbollah, because she didn't accept people, family for people they are fighting with Hezbollah.
So she's checking that these are not Hezbollah people?
She's checking, yes.
Why is that? Is she worried?
Yes, because if there is any family from Hezbollah, maybe they will come to their family.
They've left their homes behind because of the fighting. Did they bring anything with them? Did they just leave everything?
No one. Just they come with one clothes and they say they will buy a second a few days later. All they come in 1 or 2 cars maximum, you know, and just the people inside the car and some small food. And, you know, there is people, they have the period and they can't change the pads for them.
Gosh, so the women just don't have what they need.
Some people they have, but there is no bathroom in the road to change the pads.
So what is the mood of the people like? How worried are they?
Tired. Just they need house to go and sleep and to take rest, because the kids, they make them crazy in the car.
What do they tell you about Hezbollah?
The people, they come from the south, from the border, they still supported Hezbollah.
Do they think they will win, that Hezbollah will beat Israel?
Yes, and also they are saying about if they cross the border by tank and like that, Israel will be in trouble. This is what they believe, I don't know.
How is all this for you? This is clearly putting a lot of burden on your family.
Yeah, till now we feel safe. But if anything more urgent, I don't know what we will do. I try to help, but what I can do, what I need to do, you know, when you are in war and people, they try to come to you, what you can say?
Fadi there, who is putting up quite a lot of people who have escaped from the fighting, speaking to me from his town, not far from Lebanon. Well, we've heard that some of those fleeing from Hezbollah strongholds in the south of Lebanon believe that Hezbollah will be able to defeat Israel. But after a week that has seen intensive airstrikes, as well as those pager and walkie-talkie attacks, how much damage has been done to Hezbollah itself? I've been speaking to Hilal Khashan, who's a professor of political science at the American University of Beirut.
Hezbollah has sustained significant losses, I would say dramatic losses. First, the Israelis detonated their pagers, and then Israel attacked and eliminated Hezbollah's military commanders. And yesterday morning, Israel launched its massive air campaign against Hezbollah. The Israelis are saying today that Hezbollah now today is not what it used to be, meaning that they have largely depreciated their military capabilities.
They are still able to fire rockets into Israel, though, aren't they? But is that capacity seriously diminished?
The Israelis are saying that they destroyed dozens of thousands of Hezbollah's missiles and rockets. To what extent is that true? That remains to be seen. But the question is not whether they succeeded in destroying that many rockets or not. The question is Hezbollah's capability to launch rockets and missiles into Israel. Before this confrontation got underway, estimates suggested that Hezbollah would be able to launch between 2,000 to 3,000 missiles daily at Israel. What Hezbollah was able to launch today was 210 rockets. So this is telling, it means what people assumed about Hezbollah's military capabilities has been diminished significantly.
They still have stockpiles of weapons, though, presumably, even if they can't launch them. Do we have any sense of how big those stockpiles are?
We don't know for sure. Nobody counted them. But, people assume that Hezbollah has between 150,000 to 200,000 rockets and missiles. Most of them are short-range Katyushas that are ineffective and they never hit a target. Israel has succeeded, and I am aware of what I am saying. I think Israel has succeeded in decimating Hezbollah. I mean, they are unable to launch significant counterattacks against the Israelis. On the Lebanese side, casualties have been staggering. Yesterday alone, more than 550 people were killed.
But what of the state that stands behind Hezbollah? What about Iran and the signals it is sending?
Iran is a paper tiger. Iran created the Arab Shiite militias to fight on its behalf. Iran, after the end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1988, became determined to avoid a direct confrontation with its enemies. Yesterday, the Iranian president said that Hezbollah alone cannot face Israel, a strong country that is supported by the West, namely the U.S. He did not make any reference to Iran's willingness to come to the rescue of Hezbollah. Iran does not fight anybody. Iran uses proxies to fight. And this was the main reason why the Vienna nuclear talks crumbled.
You're talking there about the efforts by the Biden administration to restart the Iran nuclear talks Donald Trump pulled out of that agreement.
Yes, sir. Now, the Iranian president yesterday said that he is willing to reactivate those talks. Apparently, he wants to find a way out for Hezbollah to salvage Hezbollah from total military destruction. I think Iran has come to realize that it is cornered and its isolation is increasing in the region and it is losing its regional proxies. So it has to make some significant concessions.
That was Hilal Khashan, professor of political science at the American University of Beirut. And later on in the programme, we'll be able to speak to the BBC's senior international correspondent, Ola Girin, who is in the southern Lebanese city of Tyre. Before that, though, a story on our own shores. And Sakir Starmer used his keynote address to the Labour Party conference today to promise the country the keys to a newly refurbished building, a renewed Britain, he said, with improved public services and greater protections for working people. In a speech that was short on new policy announcements, he said there would be trade-offs, though. Communities would, for example, have to accept unpopular new electricity pylons and new prisons, and he would have to take unpopular decisions, such as means testing pensioners' winter fuel allowance. Well, after the calls from his party for a more optimistic message, Sakir did use his first conference speech as Prime Minister to speak about the light at the end of the tunnel, but also about the difficult, perhaps darker, more painful times that would come before. Although he ended on a defiant note.
People said we couldn't change the party, but we did. People said we wouldn't win across Britain, but we did. People say we can't deliver national renewal, but we can and we will. We will stabilise our economy, clear out the Tory rot, fix the foundation and deliver the mandate of change. A Britain built to last, built with respect, built with pride, because together we have shown that Britain belongs to you. Thank you, conference. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, conference.
Well, Steve Reid is the Secretary of State for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. I put it to him that there was still plenty of gloom among the Prime Minister's more optimistic talk of a positive future.
Keir gave such an upbeat vision of the better Britain that we can become. We have to fix the foundations so that we can build that more optimistic vision for our country on the most secure of foundations. Keir's not shying away from the fact that there will be difficult decisions in that, but if we get it right, then we will be able to cut the cost of living that is causing so much misery for households up and down this country by, for instance, investing in clean energy so we can cut people's energy bills. We can invest back in the National Health Service to cut waiting times. And in my job, I'm charged with making sure as Environment Secretary we can clean up our rivers after we saw record levels of pollution swilling down them under the Conservative government.
Yes, not shying away, doubling down on perhaps the most unpopular decision already taken, which is winter fuel payments. And the fact of the matter is that millions of pensioners are going to lose out. And many of those pensioners in the sort of the coldest homes are in the countryside, aren't they? Is this something you're going to address? Are you going to put in place any measures that would alleviate the impact of this on those poorer pensioners who live in rural areas?
I do think we have to level with the British people and not pretend that we can just duck difficult decisions at every turn. And that decision about winter fuel payments was undoubtedly a difficult one. It will still be paid to the poorest million pensioners who will be targeted with additional support. But it's important to say in this context as well, Labour supports the triple lock. The triple lock for pensions saw the new pension this year go up by £900 and the previous pension for people who are on that go up by £700.
Yeah,
next
but
year.
That's not going to affect, just on that point, it's not going to affect every pensioner in the same way, is it? I think more than half of the pensioners are not going to get that number. That broader figure hides a more subtle story.
Well, I mean, the broad truth of it is that pensioners who are on the new pension who retired since 2016 are £900 better off this winter than last winter. Pensioners who are on the older pension will be on average £690 better off. So almost all pensioners will be better off this winter than the previous winter, despite those changes. So there is no need for anybody to turn the heating off.
He talked about light at the end of the tunnel, but of course he also talked about that tunnel, said that there's going to be more pylons, that people are basically going to have to suck up because there is the need for more electricity, and that's the way to do it to get to your net zero aims. Are you prepared then to override what are pretty significant objections from some people in rural areas to those pylons going up?
There's a bigger prize here, isn't there? You know, you could talk about housing as well. We want lower energy bills. We don't want to be dependent on the decisions taken by fossil fuel dictators like Vladimir Putin. We want to take back control of our energy. So we're going to invest in clean wind, wave, solar and nuclear energy. We have to then build the infrastructure to get that energy from where it's generated to where it will be used. That means putting the energy infrastructure in place. That is the bigger prize. In the end, it leads to lower bills for people. We need to build 1.5 million new homes because we have a desperate shortage of housing in this country. Keir was talking as well about, you know, the number of veterans from the armed forces, care leavers sleeping rough on our streets because we don't have enough homes. Those homes will be built. That means some people are going to see more homes built in the area where they live. Some people are going to see those pylons built in the area where they live. There will always be conversations with those communities. It's going to be, in some cases, difficult to take the decisions that get us there, but this government will not shy away from it. The last government tried that, and look what happened. A flatlining economy and no pay rise for Britain for a decade, and our public service is falling apart.
We have the Chancellor giving the details of the budget at the end of next month. We know what she is not going to raise taxes on, but there's still plenty of speculation of what she will do, because she has been clear that there will be tough decisions on taxes. And one possible one is on fuel taxes, fuel duty going up. And that's something that would affect rural areas disproportionately, isn't it? Is that something that you are prepared to see, or is that a corner of your brief that you are fighting?
I'm the Secretary of State for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and I will fight the corner for those parts of the country that I am responsible for. Of course I will.
Steve Reid, Secretary of State for the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. Let's return to our main story, Lebanon, where Israeli strikes targeting Hezbollah have forced tens of thousands of people to flee from the country's south. Israel wants to return its own displaced citizens to the areas near the border with Lebanon without the threat of Hezbollah rockets. Let's speak to Ola Geerin, the BBC senior international correspondent. She's in Tyre in southern Lebanon. Ola, for days we've been saying that Israel and Hezbollah are on the brink of all-out war. What does it feel like to you today?
Well, we made the journey from Beirut to the south today, and it was very striking how many people were still on the roads, how many people were still fleeing. At the edge of Beirut, there was bumper-to-bumper traffic. We saw families on the move, some on foot. We saw families crowded onto motorbikes. We saw at one stage a father walking, carrying his child. We saw somebody else dragging a suitcase behind them. People were literally running for their lives yesterday, and some are still doing that today. And we know from the Lebanese authorities that 28,000 people were registered yesterday alone as being displaced from the south. The death toll was more than 550,000 people. We don't yet know how many of those were civilians, but we do know that 50 children were among the dead. So it was a devastating day for Lebanon. Israel saying that it hit more than 1,500 targets. What's very striking, Jamie, is that it has not managed to stop the rocket fire from across the border. Israel itself saying today that Hezbollah has managed to fire 300 rockets across the border. We heard some of those ourselves. We heard outgoing fire from Hezbollah. We heard incoming Israeli strikes. And at one stage, we saw the red tracer of Hezbollah rockets going across the sky. So the whole point of this for Israel was to stop those rockets. After everything it has done this week, those rockets are still being fired. And the United Nations is warning, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warning that Lebanon, as he put it, is on the brink.
Ola, many thanks. Ola Geerin there with that live update from southern Lebanon. A quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. The main headlines so far on The World Tonight: the government is sending 700 additional military personnel to Cyprus to prepare for a potential evacuation of British nationals from Lebanon. And Sir Keir Starmer has struck a more optimistic tone in his first speech to the Labour Party conference as Prime Minister, saying change has begun. Now, Joe Biden has been making his final address to the UN General Assembly as US president. And as part of that address, he had a message for President Putin.
He set out to destroy Ukraine, but Ukraine is still free. He set out to weaken NATO, but NATO is bigger, stronger, more united than ever before, with two new members, Finland and Sweden. But we cannot let up. world now has another choice to make. Will we sustain our support to help Ukraine win this war and preserve its freedom? Or walk away and let aggression be renewed and a nation be destroyed? I know my answer. We cannot grow weary. We cannot look away.
Ukraine's president, meanwhile, was addressing a special session of the UN Security Council today. During his time in the United States, President Zelensky has said that he'll be presenting a plan for victory, both to President Biden and to the two people who are hoping to succeed him, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, although the details of that plan have not been shared. He is also expected to keep pressing for permission to fire US weapons into Russia, arguing that talks alone will not end the war, but that Russia must be forced to make peace.
One day in this hall, it will surely be said that Russia's war against Ukraine has ended, not frozen, not paused, not forgotten, truly ended. And this will happen not because someone got tired of the war, not because someone traded something with Putin. Russia's war against Ukraine will end because the UN Charter will work. It must work. Our Ukrainian right to self-defense must prevail.
President Zelensky there speaking to the UN Security Council today. So what might be in his victory plan? I've been speaking to the former defense minister of Ukraine, Andriy Zakharodnik.
All we heard from the people who have seen it already from U.S. Government, and we do have some comments of people who have like discussed it, for example, members of Senate and so on. They're all saying, first of all, they give a comment that this is about the changing reality on the ground, that this is actually pushing Russia to understanding that they're not going to win this, they cannot move further, and they will have to back off. That's what we're hearing all the time, and I believe, based on that, perhaps it makes sense to think that the majority of the plan would be about this, about the changing the military balance.
And would that involve the West, the United States, sending not just long-range missiles, but also to send missiles for Ukraine's F-16s?
Overall idea should be around the fact that Russian territory needs to be hit because they use that territory to strike Ukraine. It is virtually impossible to defend just on the territory of Ukraine because Russia actively uses the areas of hundreds of kilometers behind this border to generate forces, to launch rockets, to launch the missiles. For that reason, inability to strike in Russia would essentially mean that Ukraine cannot defend itself. So that's a general military necessity. It's not some kind of a favor or anything like this he's asking about.
But it is something that President Biden has been reluctant to agree to. Do you get any sense that he's coming round to agreeing?
Honestly, it's very difficult to understand what's happening there because what we know is that there's immense pressure from U.S., some expert community, military community, even political community in some way, because indeed there is no point of supporting Ukraine if Ukraine cannot effectively defend itself. So it's not even the question of the ambition of the plan in terms of which part of Ukraine is going to be liberated. I don't think this is the key question right now. The key question is, can Ukraine prevail on the front?
Yeah, when you say it's not a question of which parts of Ukraine are liberated, that implies that Ukraine is going to have to accept that some parts of its territory will not be returned to it in the short term.
Well, first of all, there is absolutely no signal right now that there's going to be negotiations with Putin simply because Russia is not planning any at the moment. I mean, they are considering that without those ability of Ukraine to strike, they're going just to keep moving and actually to even start negotiations, to even put them in a situation when they will have to negotiate. Ukraine needs to be in a stronger position. Ukraine needs to be in a position to make Russia think that Russia is going to be losing.
What about the timetable in U.S. politics and the real chance that President Trump will be back in the White House at the beginning of next year? How does that feed into President Zelensky's calculations, do you believe?
It's difficult to say because, of course, we have no idea what Trump administration, if it comes to the to White House, what their policy will be. Because right now, what Trump is saying is that he will stop the war in 24 hours, which is amazing. I mean, if it's realistic in any case, but he hasn't provided any specific understanding to anyone how he's going to do that. There's been a lot of speculation of his team or his former team or his possible team. But nothing special. He can easily be very persuasive to Ukraine because he can simply say, okay, Ukraine is no longer receiving aid, you know, and of course he will put then us in an extremely difficult position. But then the question was, he's going to say to Russia because he needs to, if he wants to Putin to stop the war, he needs to tell him something which will make him stop. Otherwise, he will just simply continue.
That was Ukraine's former defence minister, Andriy Zaharodnyuk. Well, living in a country at war like Ukraine can have all kinds of unforeseen impacts on people's lives. When you have experienced rocket and gunfire, the sounds of a gunshot in a more benign context of a sporting event can bring on or indeed bring back trauma. But now there is an alternative to the starting pistol, and it was used at a marathon in the Ukrainian capital Kyiv over the weekend. This is the sound that the runners heard at the starting line. Well, that alternative starting sound was designed by Gus Coven, who's a lead sound designer and joins us now from Los Angeles. So welcome to the program, Gus.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
First of all, your reason for doing this, it's personal, isn't it, as much as professional? There's a reason that you did this.
Yeah, well, I do have a daughter who has special needs, and she has sensitivities to loud sounds, as do a lot of her friends. So when I was told about this sound and this opportunity, I immediately jumped at it because it has so much meaning for me.
So how did you approach this?
We didn't start with a blank slate. There were a series of requirements that were needed for this sound. And so the sound needed to be clear and needed to do a lot of the things that a pistol shot would do, but without traumatizing people. You know, in this marathon in particular, you have a lot of war veterans. And it was also a marathon that has... I believe that they had people in wheelchairs and people who were neurodiverse, and so it needed to be an exciting sound, but it needed to also have the components that one would need to have at the beginning of a race, right? That where you have a really loud burst. And that everybody can hear, and that it's crystal clear.
Did you test out different versions to work out whether people could hear it, whether it had
yes.
the effect of actually getting them to start running?
Yeah. So we ended up making probably close to 50 sounds, and then we narrowed those sounds down to 4 or 5 sounds that were then tested at a university in Kyiv. On people who were war veterans, some of whom were suffering from PTSD. And the sound that was eventually selected was the sound that met all the criteria for a starting sound, but also caused the least amount of trauma.
And beyond countries like Ukraine, where, as you say, people are traumatized by war, are there any other places where you think this could replace the old gunshot?
I hope so. I mean, I'm a runner myself, and I feel as though, you know, you're there at the starting line, right? You've taken your gels, you've drunk your electrolytes, you're ready to go, and then there's this sound that all of a sudden stresses you out as you're about to start. So I feel like there's room, there's a place for replacing the pistol sound everywhere. I mean, certainly here in the U.S. Where we have, you know, we have a lot of gun violence. So I think it's not just war, it's everywhere.
Gus, many thanks for joining us. That's Gus Coven, who designed that new starting sound that was trialled at the marathon in Kyiv. Now, devolved government was restored to Northern Ireland back in February, but years of political uncertainty there have left a corrosive legacy on public services. One group of people who have been affected by this are parents who are raising children with complex needs, including autism, children who often act aggressively. The NHS used to provide those families with one or two nights a month of respite care, but health service cuts and rising demand mean that that is no longer on offer. And this is a subject of a BBC Spotlight programme that has just begun on BBC One Northern Ireland. It's also available to watch on iPlayer. And joining us now to discuss this are Laura Flanagan, who's mother of 16-year-old Owen, and Sherelle Stewart, Northern Ireland Director of the National Autistic Society. Good evening to both of you.
Good evening.
Laura, what has it meant for you to have some kind of respite?
Well, when we did get respite, to be a normal family with our daughter, things that we couldn't do with our son when he was there, like take her to the park, take her to the cinema, all those kind of things that we just couldn't do when he was there, we had the opportunity to do them whenever he was in respite. It also just meant it was time for us maybe to actually go to bed when you felt tired, to have a lie-in in the morning, to go out for a meal, basic things that other people sort of take for granted, that we sort of had to wait for that little one or two day slot that hopefully we would get, we could have the opportunity to do those things.
So what is it like now when you don't have that break?
Every day is very much like the next. Owen's needs sort of dominate family life and where we can go and what we can do. Really, he doesn't do anything that a normal child would do. You can't parks with him because of his behavioural issue. Family life is pretty much you're stuck at home. Even if you try and take him to his grandparents' house, it depends on his behaviour. You know, if he's agitated and you know that it could lead to an incident, you have to take him home again. So you're stuck at home and you're just trying to get through the day, really.
Laura, we're going to come back to you. The line's breaking up a little bit, but we're getting most of what you're saying. Sherelle, if I can ask you, what has this meant for families like Laura's? I mean, she was explaining the day-to-day reality, but more broadly, what have you found for families who have had these services taken away from them?
Well, this has been going on for quite a number of years, and actually COVID, I think, just was the death knell, really. So what has been happening is that services, respite services, really basically stopped completely during COVID, and an awful lot of this led to family breakdown, which meant that children who could no longer live at home were then put into respite centres. So the respite centres, because residential facilities were full, were repurposed in order to house children who were suffering from family breakdown. Nobody was getting respite, and so the vicious circle has continued to the point where there are no residential facilities here in Northern Ireland at present, and there are very, very little respite centres open for families to use.
Are there any alternatives being thought of?
Occasionally there are things like direct payments, but direct payments are really not appropriate for these families who are caring 24/7 with, in the case of Laura, you know, a large son who is 6'2" and is very, very strong. So trying to get direct payment workers really to work is very, very challenging. And it's like another job on top of their 24/7 caring responsibility.
What would you like to see happen?
Well, basically, the Northern Ireland Executive needs to take action now. We need to get new residential facilities up and running, and we need to get enough respite centres up and running so that we can stop families hitting crisis. respite is meant to be there to stop that situation. And without it there, we're finding more families are going to end up in residential care.
Laura, I think we've got you back. The Belfast Trust, in response to your concerns, said it was very sorry it's unable to offer overnight breaks. It's currently exploring how to reintroduce them. It says it's doing all it can to provide support for autistic children. Are there other forms of support that could help you that would not involve these respite breaks?
Really, the respite breaks are invaluable. I mean, there is some workers from the Belfast Trust that would come in a few hours a week and they would help us look after one. But basically, we still are there in our own home. We can't leave. We can't go to the shop. Can't go anywhere, really. So respite means that we can actually leave our own home to go out to do things that people, other people would normally do, you know, go and visit other relatives, things like that. So respite, just, it can't be replaced. You know, it's essential to give you that break, that chance to clear your head, the chance to get some sleep, just to regroup, to be able to manage the next day again, you know. So it's something really invaluable. And I think that's why people who haven't got respite for such a long period of time are getting to the point where the only thing that really is going to replace that is a residential place, which obviously the Belfast Trust can't provide either.
Sherelle, alternative places to go? I mean, plans, as you said, to even send people, you know, to parts of Britain.
Yeah, I mean, this is the one thing that quite a number of the trusts seem to be offering when someone requests a residential placement, and that is out of jurisdiction care. These families desperately love their children and they want to be continuing to be involved in their lives. It is not a moral, ethical choice to send a child to an out of jurisdiction care. It's also very costly. That money should be used in order to build the facilities here in Northern Ireland so people can continue to keep their child close at home and continue to have that relationship.
Sherelle Stewart, Northern Ireland Director of the National Autistic Society, and Laura Flanagan, mother of 16-year-old Owen. Thanks, both of you, for joining us. That Spotlight programme is called I Am Not OK, and you can watch it on BBC iPlayer. Our closing headlines tonight. The Prime Minister has told British nationals in Lebanon now is the time to leave. The government has ramped up plans to potentially evacuate British nationals from Lebanon as concerns are growing about the escalating violence between Israel and Hezbollah. An additional 700 UK military personnel are being flown to Cyprus tonight. They're joining 500 who were sent there earlier this year. At least 10,000 UK citizens are still believed to be in Lebanon. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and from everyone on the programme, good night.
The studio engineers were Mike Campbell and Tom Bartlett. Tonight's editor, Matthew Symington.